Welcome to Matters of Experience, a podcast that explores the creativity, innovation and psychology driving designed experiences and encounters. If you're new to the show, a hearty welcome, and to our regular listeners, thank you for tuning in and supporting our conversation. My name is Abigail Honor.
Hello, this is Brenda Cowan.
Today, we're talking with a very recognizable voice in our community, literally and figuratively, Jonathan Alger. Jonathan, many know you as the co-founder and managing partner of C&G Partners, where your clients run the gamut and include the 9/11 Museum, NASA, Cornell, the Smithsonian, US Department of State, I can go on. You've been honored by more initialisms than I can pronounce sequentially on this show because I tried, as well as being a two-time winner of the AM Muse Awards. He's also served two terms as the president of SEGD, and recently, we're all enjoying your podcast and newsletter, Making the Museum. Jonathan, a huge welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here. Thank you both for having me. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you, Jonathan. I happen to know that you're a musician, you're an avid reader, and I think of it as a collector of amazing true or sometimes not so true facts and anecdotes. You always seem to have an incredible story to share that inevitably leaves me wondering, is that for real? I also know that you appreciate it when others in your firm have and share what I'll call out-of-work talents, such as art making and music. So tell us, how do your myriad personal and professional interests and talents synergize into the work that you do?
I don't know. I think that if I were giving advice to somebody today about pursuing a career or creating a company or both, I'm not sure I would advise them to do what we have done, because I'm not sure that the environment is really conducive to that. You know, nowadays it's all about specializing, and what we do is sort of neither specializing nor generalizing, but somewhere in between. And I think that's a difficult spot to be in, I think. But for us, it's been great. We love the lifestyle of multi-specialty work. And so we're in my firm, I do a lot of exhibition design and experience design. That's what I write about. That's what I podcast about. That's what I'm sort of most known for. But coming up in the business, I did all the other things that you would think a traditional communication design person would do, branding and wayfinding and digital projects and print and all of that sort of stuff. So it was sort of a apprenticeship that felt a little bit more like learning how to run or learning how to do the decathlon rather than learning how to run the 100-meter dash only. But, you know, again, I'm not sure that that's business advice I would give anyone today. Like, do not set out to become a medium-sized Swiss Army knife.
I feel the exact same way. We don't have an elevator pitch for what we do. Every time I meet a client, it's really hard because when you are medium size, small to medium, I think we're probably a bit smaller than you guys, and you're trying to pitch what you do, but you have a depth or a multidisciplinary team that can actually do branding, do wayfinding, for example, experience design, VR, AR, digital design, whatever it is in your Swiss Army knife. It's really hard to be able to pitch that to clients when they're often just looking for one thing.
That's right.
I'm always trying to say, what's your problem and let us fix it. Don't come to us for a set specific task. How are some of the challenges, as you mentioned, you have this rich team and they have a lot of things they can do. How do you see the next 5 years in terms of your business? Do you ever think, oh, we need to specialize? It would be better to be one size fits all for people? Or like, what's your perception on that?
I have no idea. I like to be able to answer with a very fluid and cogent words to live by that people could whip their notebook out on and start scribbling away. But I don't really have an answer for that. I think we're maybe birds of a feather. We've been around long enough that we've just got a pretty big portfolio in each one of those areas. So when a client comes to us with a particular specialty they want, we just show them that. Every once in a while, we come across a client that needs, you know, pineapples, storm doors, and to be flown in an airplane, and we can handle them as well.
So in terms of like C&G, you know, you're very much known for a focus on cultural nonprofit work. Why is it? Tell us like that special focus and why it's important for you.
Our firm, C&G Partners, is a descendant firm of another firm called Chermayeff & Geismar. And Chermayeff & Geismar is a sort of a original gangster formed in the 50s, old school New York graphic design firm, one of the firms that invented or popularized the term graphic design, and was one of the very first firms ever to do exhibition design as a firm, actually. And I just happened to luckily get an opportunity to work there, and I started there as a junior designer, and I left there as one of the principals of the firm, and then started this firm, which is a descendant. And that firm, for whatever reason, probably personal interest, et cetera, just didn't do much commercial work, didn't do much marketing, didn't sell soap, as we used to say. And so the firm that I now am the managing partner of and one of the owners of is following suit. And that started to refine itself even more when we created this firm 20 years ago. We started eventually after 5-10 years in, we realized that 85-90% of our clients and our financial health was coming from the broadly defined cultural sector. And so we said, let's just plant a flag and not actively go after commercial projects as much.
Oh, that's really interesting. Financially, was that a gamble?
You know, like I'm fond of saying, like nonprofit is a tax status, not a business goal. So well-run nonprofits, we work with a lot of nonprofits, we work with a lot of government entities, we work with NGOs, et cetera. Let's think about some nonprofits that we know well by name. Harvard, the Smithsonian, National Geographic, I don't know, NASA, if you want to include government entities. These, I don't think you'd think of any of those entities as being poorly funded. So I think something like 10% of the workforce in the United States works in the nonprofit sector writ large. And so it's a good place to be. You can even be a niche within a niche, and that's where we are doing arts and culture.
So when I think about how it is that C&G brings voices, people, the human, into your exhibition projects, and how it is that, in my interpretation, it makes for very inclusive environments, it makes for, again, very human environments. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about how it is that you think or you approach projects with a human element in mind. Or is it the kind of thing that just sort of develops heuristically?
There's always been an issue with museums taking a stand and having a very firm opinion about something. In some cases, it's sort of incontrovertible. We are the Museum of Forks. Forks have tines, and on the other end is a part where you hold them, right? You can say that if you're the Museum of Forks, if you're the curator of the Museum of Forks, you can say things like that. But otherwise, we work with a lot of museums and museum-like entities that are a little bit uncomfortable with sort of taking a stand. So one of the, I don't know, tricks or hacks or rules of thumb that we've stumbled on and gone with is this idea of the personal testimony trick. The idea that if we can get someone who's maybe not a subject matter expert, they're not an SME, they're just somebody else who has lived experience, or they're adjacent to the subject, or they may not know everything about chemistry, but they work in a lab, and we have them say what they feel about a subject, then that's a great way for visitors to have a way in that's a little bit more understandable to them. It's also a great way for museums to avoid looking like there's only one answer and that people are supposed to look to them for some kind of absolute truth. So that's the sort of the personal testimony trick. And you can do that a number of ways. You can do that like we're doing right now, recording something in audio. You can also do it in writing.
I'm really curious, as a leader, how it is that you effectively communicate or even educate clients about the work that you do. It's a particular form of communication, I would suggest, and I'm really curious, how do you approach that?
Yeah, I'd say some people refer to that as sort of consulting or educational consultative relationship with your clients. Other people refer to it as being long-winded and pedantic. I guess it depends on the situation, but I don't mind at all trying to help clients understand every aspect of something that they might want to understand. And some people are like that. You know, on the show that I do, I just had a guest who is a specialist in museum display cases. And you can tell that she loves to explain that stuff to people. And that is stuff that really needs to be explained to people. And 9 times out of 10, the clients that we're working with are people who have never done this before. They may very well never do it again. They may decide never to do it again. Every once in a while, they decide to do it again. But when you go in and you want to have your knee operated on, there's some people who are just like, hey, fix my knee, okay, knock me out, take care of it. But there are other people who say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. What are my options? What's entailed? I think you just have to do that.
Given what you've just said in terms of the education, if you have money and you need to build a museum, they automatically, the clients think, I need an architect. I keep finding us in situations where whenever we're brought in, the client has already made some decisions, like even buying hardware too early.
Oh, yeah. We get that all the time.
And it's...
Yeah, the AV salespeople got to them. They got to them.
Exactly. How do
That's
we...
a really big LED wall. It's curving.
It's exactly like that, yeah. So how do we build a better understanding of our industry and how to work through these projects and our process with clients, or build that awareness so they're doing it in the right order at least?
That's a super question. I've never really thought exactly about that. You know, everyone around this table is sort of around the same table, right? We don't have a client sitting in the fourth chair over there. So if I take your question correctly, is how can we make sure that before we show up, the clients know what it is that we're going to do and they're starting to make the right decisions, et cetera. So I don't know. Maybe, SEGD, the Society for Experiential Graphic Design, has just started this new group, professional practice group, that is for people to do exhibition and experience design. Maybe we should focus one of the committees of that group on creating some kind of website or page at SEGD.org or literature or something that could somehow be distributed. You could use the sort of the power and the force of a larger organization and kind of do a got milk campaign. Like if we're all dairy farmers, you could do a bit of a got milk campaign, not to create demand for our bovine liquid, but to make the client sort of understand, you know, what the basic steps are.
Yeah, and who they need sitting around the table at the beginning.
That's a great idea. I'm going to go do that right now. I'm going to leave.
I would suggest that you're already underway with doing this, or at least into begin our segue, actually, into talking about making the museum. Part of what I see happening is you making a very substantial contribution to providing everyone, and certainly, you know, prospective clients or existing clients, with a vocabulary, with an understanding of the tools, the techniques, and understanding the functions and the possibilities of, you know, what I think of as a very kaleidoscopic profession. And I'm curious, was that your intention, or do you see yourself doing that? Because from the outside, it seems that that is a huge part of your outcomes.
So making the museum, shameless plug, you can look at makingthemuseum.com, dear listener, is both a podcast, which is attempting to be as good as the podcast that I'm on right now, but is falling very short.
Au contraire. Yeah.
But is also a newsletter. It started out as a newsletter, and I was writing 5 very short, 1-minute read newsletters per week. And now it's 3 times a week by popular demand or popular undemand. And that started 2 ways. One was sort of a selfish way. I'd had a lifelong dream to attempt to get over my absolutely fundamental terror of writing in public, doing something where it wasn't just business emails, but something where I was purely writing and I was asking people to look at my writing. I went through school with a whole bunch of friends who are, you know, writers for a business. And I always thought that that was great. And I thought that I couldn't do it. I tried and it was terrible. And I wanted to tackle that monster. And so I did that. I took courses and yada, yada. And the other thing was this thing that people do is a small community. Even if you were to say, okay, all the people who do museum exhibition, and let's add all the people who do theme park work, let's add them in, and let's add people who do themed retail, and let's add cruise ships, and visitor centers, and alumni centers, zoos, you know, all of that. Even if we brought all of those people together, it would still be a fairly small number. So back to architects, last time I checked, there was like 80,000. There's probably 120,000 members of the AIA right now. But SCGD itself has, what, 2,000? So it's a relatively small group. And that means that there isn't a critical mass adequate to generate a criticism, a textual communication. There isn't writing in the field, per se, except here and there. And the other gap is professional development, that there isn't a way that you can get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee and get your one-word-a-day calendar about your profession. Or, you know, every month you take a little continuing education unit or something. And it's like, ooh, storm drain flashing. Great, you know. And I just felt that I could combine those two things. I can combine that interest in writing, the fact that I've been doing it for a number of years, and I can share what I've learned.
One of the things I just want to pick on what you said, Jonathan, is you had a need to write. You didn't feel comfortable writing, and you forced yourself through that discomfort to achieve the goal that was pushing you forwards. But only from doing that and facing those fears and facing those obstacles and overcoming, do you ever accomplish anything. So unfortunately, in order to accomplish anything, you have to go through the quagmire and put yourself in an uncomfortable situation to get the other side.
Abby, you're totally right. I think that there's this big realm of discomfort that you have to aim for. I've done projects with clients. Some of my client work has been insanely uncomfortable for me. Things where we're working with a client group that I don't think I have anything in common with. I don't agree with in some ways. I agree with the project they're doing, but there's something else about who they are that maybe on a personal basis I wouldn't agree with. And the thing that I find all the time is once you get through this sort of weird Mordor, on the other side, you're like, what? That wasn't Mordor at all. What was I worried about? That zone of discomfort turns out, in retrospect, looking back at it, to be wonderful. I've had clients that I thought were going to be just, I don't know how we're going to get through this. And you kind of figure it out. And after the first meeting, everybody is like, you know, going out to lunch together individually. You're like, what?
Yeah, I completely agree. And also dealing in the moment that it's not comfortable with the job where you've overreach somewhere, or you feel you may be overreaching, or you're not all on the same page, whatever the challenge is, learning to deal with the stress of that is something that I'm constantly challenged with.
Well, this is something we had on a recent podcast, Sarana Pringle from Yale, who does studies and research in creativity and emotional intelligence. And this was a piece of what she was talking about and what she studies, which is for the creative person, and I would say for a creative leader as well, being able to enter into discomfort and being able to manage not knowing how this is going to turn out or where this is going to go is an enormous skill. And it's something that you have as a significant tool in your toolbox.
Yeah, I think that's often the case when you're an entrepreneur, or you're a business leader, or you're a partner in a firm, or you're trying to negotiate any kind of new possibility. It's highly likely that some aspect of what you're being asked to do is something that you currently are not a master of, and it simply doesn't work that you would attempt to become a master of the thing in advance and then seek out somebody, because all of the engagements are unique. They're all one-offs, right? They're all very individual. We just finished a project for, it's an interactive university project at a lab of ornithology, where the median visitor is a 62-year-old white female with expensive binoculars. If I had attempted to become the master of that before we began that, I don't know, I'd have a very long gray beard, and then they would have chosen somebody else. So you have to be willing to knit the parachute on the way down a little bit. You have to be confident that you can do it. You have to have a record of having done that many times before to be confident, like, sure, I can jump out the plane.
Mm-hmm. What about fear of failure? Do you think some of the motivation is because you're like, I'm not going to fail? I cannot fail. Or how do you deal with failure? Because we all fail, right? You fail forward. That's how you learn. That's how you grow. I'm a big believer in failure. So how do you deal with it?
I like that. I'm gonna make a mug. I'm a big believer in failure. I like that. Yeah, you have to acknowledge that you will have failure, but you have to make the right bets, right? Everything is thinking in bets. So there are situations where you're guaranteed to fail. Take on situations like that deliberately and for a specific reason. Otherwise, try to find situations where you could possibly not fail and just do everything you can to not fail.
It's a delicate balance, though, right? Because as you're boldly going where you haven't gone before, trying something new or part new, there is still probably, if we were betting people, a percentage of failure always.
Right. And you do fail. You do fail. That's for sure. You get more points for, you know, most improved player is sort of more impressive than player who yet again won player of the year.
Well, you're never starting from zero after you have gone for something, you've attempted something, you fail, and when you go again, you're not starting from zero. And I think that that is a reality, and it's also a mindset that can really, you know, it's like an abundance mindset. It really enables you, I would suggest, to be able to build the skill and to perhaps end up mastering whatever the case might be.
Yesterday, we did a pitch for a big commercial campaign. And we made the images in AI. We brought them to life in AI. And these were science images and technology images. And so we basically made a video in 4 hours. We got the job simply because we just outworked everyone in this 4 hours and made what looked like the client could see the spots, right? We gave them that whet their appetite. And so I'm sort of shocked at how quickly it's going. And I just wondered how you felt about it, because we're already seeing clients using it. So if we're not doing it, they'll come to the table and show us what, well, last night we did this. And so we have to keep up with our clients now, because you get a client who happens to be have a creative director who's very techie, and suddenly we can't be outworked by them. So I just wondered what your, we're in a frenetic race to keep up with AI and to see how we can use it effectively. And I just wondered what your thinking was on it all.
Yeah, I think that you know, the advances in AI are not evenly distributed. Mm-hmm. It's not a linear wave that's moving up the beach, or a tsunami that's coming towards our island or whatever. It's, I don't know, it's an army where some of the phalanxes are further ahead than the other ones or something. But in what we do when we're trying to work on a physical space, it's a complex, unique, three-dimensional puzzle. In a situation like that, there is no way that AI can solve the problem for you. Once you've solved it, AI could, you know, render up something similar. In the early days of DALL-E and Midjourney, I said, you know, DALL-E, hey, I'm going to experiment with you. I'd like you to make me a photographic, realistic image of a young woman in a sundress in a museum looking at a sword that's in a vitrine. And the results were absolutely laughable. So the more specific in the early days right now for AI, the more specific that you want to get, the less joy you're going to have. And things that are already well chewed and masticated by the computers of the internet, where there's already ample material to learn on, you'll be able to do something like that. So if I were to say, hey, AI, give me a picture of a multicultural group of preppy kids drinking sodas, boy, I could get some great stuff for that. But if I were to say, like, give me an image of a really cool concept for an exhibit that's about shepherding in Iceland, it's gonna balk.
Yep. Last question. Advice to young exhibit designers.
I would say it depends. If you would like to make yourself indispensable and get a well-rounded, little bit of everything kind of an experience to go work at a firm that is looking for that, you should go sign up for Brenda's program.
Woohoo!
If you would like to work for a firm like mine, and there aren't many, or like yours, Abby, there's maybe 20, 25 firms like ours in the entire country. If you want to work for a firm like that, it's a little bit more of a mercenary outlook. And for people like that, I would recommend that you should first, you should become a T-shaped person. You should get a very broad understanding, but there should be one thing that you're very deep in. Mm-hmm. And that might be architecture. We have our head, our most senior staff member in 3D design has 2 degrees in architecture. So, and you know, likewise with graphic design, likewise with media, et cetera. So when people are hiring us and they need to get the job done well and they need to get it done quickly, et cetera, that's the kind of talent pool that we're looking for.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. This was really, really interesting and entertaining. And yeah, everybody check out MTM. It's a fantastic
It really
podcast.
Is.
Absolutely essential. Essential, I think.
Aw, I like that word.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thank you. And thanks to everyone who tuned in today. If you like what you heard, subscribe for more episodes of Massive Experience and make sure to leave a rating and a review and share with a friend. We'll see you next time.
Matters of Experience is produced by Lorem Ipsum Corp. and recorded at Hangar Studios. Tune in next time for more fun discussions about experience design.